Om Mauna Vyakya Prakatita. Om Mauna Vyakya Prakatita. Parabrahmatattvam Yuvanam. Parabrahmatattvam Yuvanam. Varashishtante Vasidvishiganayihi. Varashishtante Vasidvishiganayihi. Avritam Brahmanishtai. Avritam Brahmanishtai. Acharyendram Karakalita Chinmudram. Acharyendram Karakalita Chinmudram. Anandamurtim. Anandamurtim. Swatmaramam Muditavadanam. Swatmaramam Muditavadanam. Dakshinamurtimide. Dakshinamurtimide. Okay, we're on verse 9. Repeat after me. Buram, buram, vamsya namo nilambaram. Buram Bamsyanalo Nilambaram Aharnato Himam Shiv Puman Aharnato Himam Shiv Puman Yitya Bhati Chara Charat Makamidam Yitya Bhati Chara Charat Makamidam Yasyaiva Murchashtakam Yasyaiva Murchashtakam Nanyat kinchana vidyate vimushatam. Nanyat kinchana vidyate vimushatam. Yasmat parasmat viboho. Yasmat parasmat viboho. Tasmai Shri Guru Murtaye Namaidam. Tasmai Shri Guru Murtaye Namaidam. Shri Dakshina Murtaye. Shri Dakshina Murtaye. This is a Sandhi for Sanskrit people. Buhu Ambasi. Ambamsi. Analaha. Anilaha. Ambaram. Arhanataha. Himamshuhu. Puman. Iti. Abhati chara achara atmakam idam yasya eva murti ashtakam na anyat kinchana vidyate vimrishatam yasmat parasmat viboho Tasmai Shri Guru Murtaye Namaha Idam Shri Dakshina Murtaye. Okay. The Murti Ashtakam, sometimes Paramatma or Ishwara is divided into certain components. The what they call the Ashtakam is looking at Ishwara, the Lord, in an eightfold form. So Ashtakam means eightfold. So Murti Ashtakam means Murti. The form is Ashtakam, eightfold. And so it starts out by just listing this division of Ishwara, way of dividing up Ishwara, way of dividing up the Lord. So Buhu means the earth. Ambamsi means the waters. Anala, we can just say water. They put water in plural because drops of water, I guess, so they say water, they put it in plural. So Buhu, the earth. Ambamsi, the water. Anala means fire. Anala is an interesting word. Anala means Unalum. Alum means enough. Enough. Unalum means never enough. Mm-hmm. Like if there's a flame, like let's say if you're doing a ritual and you're offering ghee into the fire, it will never get tired of receiving that ghee. Mm-hmm. It always wants more and more and more. But wood in, more wood, more wood, more wood. It's never satisfied, never says that's enough. It'll take as much as you can give. It's a never enough, Analam. Anila means the wind. Umbadam, space. So we usually say space, air, fire, water, earth. Here they're going backwards and saying, you know, earth, water, fire, air, and space. I can hardly do it that way. the five elements. So first the five elements. Then they say, Arha Nataha. Nataha means Lord or Master. Arha De, Arha Nataha, the Lord of the Day, the Sun. It's named for the Sun. Arha Nataha. And then Himamshuhu. Hima means cool. It's named for the moon, though, Himamshuhu. So the Sun, the Himamshuhu, the moon, and Puman. Puman, in the commentary, and Swamiji also mentioned it in both ways, Puman is either the Bokta, the conscious being, all of the jivas in the creation, or Ishwara, also the Sat-Chit, the conscious being that is aware of the whole creation. So Puman means the Purusha, the person. So these are the eight, five elements, then the sun, the moon, and the conscious being. So that's the all of the components of Ishwara. And everything can fall into that, all of the different lokas, you know, all of the different worlds, you know, and even the subtle worlds, because it, as we'll see, it says that which shines. So it's, the Puman brings in the conscious aspect, the knowership. So everything is really covered. Five elements, all of the elementals are covered by the five elements, you know, and the subtle and the gross are covered by the Puman, the Bokta, the knowership. So here it says, Iti Abhati, Abhati. This Murti Ashtakam, this fivefold Murti, it shines. Means it shines. And they use the word ba. It means the thing. We don't say it this way in English. And I'm always trying to explain this. I don't know why it's hard to explain, actually. I say in this room, I know the room. I'm aware of the room. So I can talk about that from the standpoint of myself being a knower, conscious of the room. But the room is also lit up, now in this case, because of my consciousness, mm-hmm. right? So the room is appearing to me. It's manifesting to me. So here, in that way, I can look at the whole universe, say the whole universe from Ishwara's standpoint, it is lit up because of consciousness. It is known because of consciousness. But because it is known, it itself is manifest. It itself is shining, right? Like if no consciousness, say, for instance, were to fall upon something, that thing is not appearing at that time to anybody. It's not shining, from your standpoint anyway. It's not manifesting. But it is manifesting when it's known to you. That thing is shining. It is lit up from its own standpoint. So the whole thing, you say, is shining. So here, what they're saying is, this Murti, the Murti Ashtakam, this eightfold form, yesya eva, of whom? You know? So whose eightfold form, which is what? Chara achara atmakam idam. So idam goes means this. Idam Murti Ashtakam, this eightfold form, of whom? I'll see in a minute. Which is chara achara atmakam, whose nature encompasses all things moving and immovable. It's just another way of dividing up all experience. Some things are stationary, some things are moving. So just a stationary. Stationary would be something simple like stones and even trees are stationary. You know, moving are things that move from, you know, point A to point B on their own, and then they're stationary things. So just a simple way of dividing up the world. So this eightfold form, for whom, composed of moving, the chara and achara, immovable things, which is comprised of the five elements, and the sun, the moon, and the bokta, the conscious being, either as Ishwara or as the jiva. So, then it says, non-knit, I'm going to just go through the, get you familiar with the words first and then we'll unfold it. Non-yet kinchana, na anyet kinchana vidyate. There is nothing else. Na means not, anyet another, kinchit. Na anyet kinchit, kinchana vidyate. There is no other thing. There is nothing other than yasmat padasmat vibhoho. There is no other thing than this Lord, who is all-pervasive, padasmat vibhoho. For who? Vimrshatam. For the one who is, for those who have done this vichara. For the one who, for the ones who have done this analysis. All of this is nothing but the form of Ishwara. This whole creation that you experience in within this this ashtaka, this murti ashtaka, what they mean by what they do when they're trying to divide the world up like that is to make you include everything. All of the five elements, the sun, the moon, the conscious beings who are experiencing the creation, this whole thing is the form of the Lord. And then he says, and other than this, you know, there is nothing outside of this. So, na kinchana, when he says, na anyat kinchana vidyate, yasmat parasmat vibhoho. Parasmat means the paramatma. The paramatma means, the atma, the self, which is limitless. That self is, so the paramatma, parasmat, there is nothing other than the atma, the self, which is limitless, which is vibhoho. So parasmat vibhoho. Vibhoho means, comes from vibhu. And vibhoho means, has two meanings. That which is all pervasive means there's nothing away from that. And it also means that which shines variously in a variety of ways. So this whole creation, the space, air, fire, water, earth, the sun, the moon, and the conscious beings within it, this whole creation, this what they call the murti ashtaka, is the nature of the Lord. It's the manifestation of the Lord, who himself manifests in this variety of ways, and whose nature is pada. Now, pada can be taken as paramatma, the atma, which is limitless. So pada means limitless. The word limitless, or supreme or limitless, and has a Sanskrit definition for it, is this. It comes later. Desha kala vastu aparicheda. When you say something is pada, it's desha means space, kala means time, vastu means any type of objectification. This is a vastu, this is a vastu, this is a vastu. Even a thought is a vastu. Anything that can be experienced is a vastu. So desha, kala, vastu, aparicheda means that which is param, is not limited by time. It's not limited by space. Desha, kala, desha is space, kala is time. And it's not limited by any type of objectification. And by objectification, it means anything that I can experience through my sense organs or any type of vritti, thought modification in the mind, that is an objectification. So we can look at, just as when we're talking about our sense perception, as objects, or as sounds, or as tastes, any object of the sense perception, or any type of objectification in the mind, that's also. So that which is aparicheda means it's not confined by, not limited by, not contained by space, by time, or by objectification. Now, in the world of duality, everything is paricheda. Everything is limited and circumscribed by space. Something exists here, but not here. Something exists at this time, but not at that time. Something has this form, and so not this form. Right? They even say, if we take the five elements themselves, space, air, fire, water, earth, each one is limited by the other four. Right? In fact, we say for space, air, fire, water, earth, of those five elements, the one that is closest to Brahman, closest to the Atma, is space. Right? For several reasons. Let me just give you them, just so that you kind of understand this, so we can move into the Paramatma again. You can see that it's obvious that, you know, wind is sometimes blowing, sometimes not, for instance. You know, and the wind can excite the fire. Yeah. fire is in relation, water can put out the fire, right? And then the earth can be heated by fire, it can be soaked by water. They all are in relationship to one another. They also limit and affect one another. Not space. The five elements limit and they affect one another, the four elements, not space. Space is pervasive to all of the elements. I can light fire in space. You know, it can heat the air. It can be put out by the water. But it's simply existing in the space. Space is pervasive to all of them. And space is pervasive to all of them, and space is asanga. It's not attached to any element. All of the elements exist within space. So, for instance, if I take a cup and move it from point A to point B, it's not ripping through the space. Space is more subtle. So in that way, it's like Brahman. There's another thing. There are not two spaces. There's only one space, you know. There are clumps of earth all over the place, you know. So we have some earth over here, and earth over there, this fire over here, that fire over there, this wind over here, and, you know, a gentle breeze over here, and a gale over there, you know. And so there's differentiation. So there's many types of winds. There's winds in many different places, fires all over the place of different qualities, of different natures. And in fact, in India, because of ritual, they have many different names for all of the different types of fires, depending on the color of the fire, how many forks it has. And I think it's in the Mundaka Upanishad, they label a lot of the names of the different kinds of fires. But I say there's some different fires. You know, everything is objectified and has its own vastu, many different vastus, many different objects, you know. Whereas space, there aren't two spaces. We don't have a space over here and a space over there. There's one space in which all of these differentiations act as upadis to the space, which is like Brahman. Like, say, for instance, we say this is room space. But from the standpoint of space, there's no room space. From the standpoint of space, there's just space. And if I were to knock down the room, space would not be affected at all. I say, from my standpoint, I've never been contained by the room. I am one space, and all things exist in me. But no one thing contains me. You know, it may look like that from the standpoint of the room, but actually I'm going through the walls, right? I pervade the very walls. And so like that, space is one, there aren't two spaces, right? So from its own standpoint, it's one. And then one means it's not, there aren't two spaces, like there's two dogs or two, you know. And within itself, it has no parts. There are not two spaces and it has no parts. We're getting close to non-dual there. The difference is, the problem is, though, is that, you know, space is not fire, air, water, earth. It's different. These things exist in space, but they differentiate themselves from space. So space is actually one of the five elements, you know? And that element space, along with, you know, space, air, fire, water, earth, along with the other four, all of them are objectified by you. And that's why you often don't think about that. But space, along with the other five elements, are known. In fact, and when you close your eyes, you know, the space is removed from your perception along with everything else that you're seeing. When you dream, also when you imagine, the space comes along with the other five elements. What's giving you the dimension? The dimension is an element that comes and goes with the dream, right? So space is an element that comes and goes with the creation. So when we say the creation, when the Vedas say the creation manifests cyclically, it comes into manifestation, is sustained, and resolves, it's not that objects within space are coming into manifestation and resolving. It's the space itself, together with the other elements, are coming into manifestation and resolving, you know? And so what this means is, because people don't necessarily think about this, but just like when you are dreaming, the whole universe, including the space, exists in the dream and collapses when the dream is over, right? Now, the conscious being who is aware of the space, air, fire, water, earth, is not going to be contained by that objectification. It's very obvious when you're thinking of it in terms of imagining the meadow or imagining or having a dream, you know, that your being is the truth of it, or the consciousness or the being in which that imagination takes place or in which the dream takes place, you know. But in this creation also, it's the same situation, because it's not just the other four elements that are objectified. The space itself is objectified. If the space is objectified and your being, right, the conscious being, is by its nature free of space, right, then what size are you? You know, it's a critical point. What size are you? And the whole idea of dimension, you know, like here in this room, I'm different from you. I'm 10 feet away from you. Right? But what is between you and I? It's space. Right? And so the space, along with all of the elements within space, enjoy the objectification of what? The conscious being. Right? So that's why when I'm doing this Driktrisha, when we do the Driktrisha Viveka, the seer-seeing differentiation, the most important, one of the most important things that's happening is this. When we do this step by step, I'm aware of this physical body, I'm aware of all of you, and so there's a subject-object relationship. I'm aware of my physical body through my sense organs, subject-object relationship between sense organs and body, the body becomes objectified. I'm aware of the sense organs themselves because of my mind. So the mind becomes, the sense organs become objectified. Then I'm aware of the thoughts themselves, the moods, the emotions, so the mind itself becomes objectified. Objectified means I'm differentiating it from the subject, from the ultimate subject. All of these things become objects. Then I can say the ahankara, the I notion itself, the I notion, the I am doing this, I am doing that, that's also objectified. But Swamiji always tends to take this further. You can go like, if you keep going, you can say, you know, my moods and emotions are objectified, the I thought is objectified, everything that I know, all of my knowledge is objectified. I know this and I know this and I know this, and I don't know this and I don't know that. We're aware of what we know and what we don't know. All of these things are objectified, they're all illumined. But you know what, then we can go farther and say, and not only that, the space itself is known to me. Right? This is all known to me. The space is known to me. Everything in the space is known to me. And now my body, mind, sense organs are all included in the space. My mind is included, you know, in the space. There's nothing that's away from, there's nothing that's not included within the totality of this duality. Right? And all of it is objectified by me. If it's objectified by me, the space itself is objectified by me, then what size am I? See, if once you objectify, if space is objectified, then what size am I? Now, if I say like this, we'll think the whole universe, says Ishwarna, the whole universe, the entire universe, comes from me, is sustained by me, resolves into me. Therefore, I must be big.
Yeah.
Right? The whole universe comes from me, sustained by me, and goes back into me. I must be really big, because the universe is big. And look at how vast, how much territory the space covers. Right? But if the space itself is objectified by me, then I can't be measured in terms of size or dimension. I can't be big and I can't be small. because I'm not an object. I'm not space, nor am I an object in space. I'm the very being, you know, because of which space is. Right? I'm the being because of which space is. I'm the consciousness because of which space is. But what size is that consciousness? See, now, even when we think of a difference between you and me, like I can do this driksha viveka, the see or seen differentiation, and I end up with myself just as conscious being. I've differentiated, I've recognized the creation on all individuals and all my own body and mind and sense organs, all objectified, and here I am. But you're all doing that too. You're like, so here I am. You know? I'm the conscious being that is stable and the innermost conscious being that can't be objectified. Here I am. You're all doing it too. When you come in and look around and say, you don't often make the jump that, well, if the space itself is objectified and me, the conscious being, am not an object within space, and we all come to that exact same conclusion, what divides us? What divides us to make me not you? Because you'll meet me to say, well, space, you're over there, and you're over there, and you're over there, and you're over there. But if space itself comes along with the creation, just like it does in the dream, then there is not any over there, or over there, or over there, for the conscious being that is not an object within space. There's no walls, there's no space, to divide us or to make us a different being. And so this, what this means is that me, the conscious being that I am, right, is the conscious being which you are, which is the conscious being which Ishvara is. And so it's one type of teaching methodology, but what you end up with as a person understands this is basically that there is nothing in this creation that's away from the one conscious being, which I am. And that all of this, in fact, right, has no being. It has no being separate from the conscious being that I am. Because of this, the conscious being that I am, when I just say me, the consciousness that you take for granted as yourself, so we just did a moment in the meditation before you couldn't go on with it. When you're sitting with just the conscious being that you are, that is the one thing in your own totality of experience that you can't touch. In the world, the thing that you can't touch or do anything to is space. Space is the most subtle thing that we have in the creation. So you can't wet space, you know, you can't pour some water on it, because the water is more subtle. I mean, the space is more subtle. You can't wet it, you can't burn it. You can't do anything to it. You can't change it anyway. You can't make it dusty. You know, the air can carry dust. But all of that is just taking place in space. Space remains clean and pure. But you're aware of the space, right? You're more subtle than the space. In fact, space is an element. From your standpoint, space is gross, in fact, from the standpoint of consciousness. So for you, there is nothing that can be done. So now, we're not talking about a you that is out of your realm of experience. There is no such you that's outside of your realm of experience. You means the conscious being that you are. The conscious being, that this conscious being, this me, is not something that you can touch or objectify or make different in any way. You know, it's not like because you're a spiritual person now, you're a spiritual person, and so you can go and, you know, make yourself more spiritual. Can, you know, make yourself, you know, an evolved being. Can you make yourself an evolved being, like a spiritual being? You know, like, is there a hierarchy? Is there a spiritual hierarchy for the Atma? You know? No, there isn't. Because the there's not a spiritual hierarchy for space. There's not a spiritual hierarchy for the Atma. consciousness is not something that you can objectify and meddle with. Like maybe you'll think, you know, if I meditate a lot, I'm going to meditate a lot. And I think if you meditate a lot, you should also eat well. So, and do some yoga also, because then we have, you know, more balance. These things are all good. I'm not putting that. I like all of these things. But yoga and a good diet, you know, yoga or Tai Chi or any of these things, they do change and modify the body. They're effective. They're very helpful. You know, like good diet and proper exercise is very, it makes a huge difference on the quality and the nature of the body. Right? Following Dharma, it has the most effect on the mind. You can do all kinds of things, all type of pranayama, meditation, all kinds of things, and if you don't follow Dharma, then it just, it's like, you know, taking an aspirin. Your meditation is like taking, well, I'd have to make it stronger than an aspirin, taking some morphine. Your meditation is like doing something to just, you know, stun the mind for a while. But when the morphine runs out, you know, runs out, then the mind comes back to its own agitated state. So, but so say you realize that, and so you follow Dharma, and then with that relatively quiet mind that comes from following Dharma, just being a normal good person, you know, golden rule person, you know, seriously, you know, following that Dharma, and then practicing, you know, meditative practices and pranayama, nididhyasana, all of these things, it does help the mind. It does give shanti to the mind. It changes the mind. You know? But what about the conscious being that illumines that changed mind? The conscious being that illumines the mind or the body that is not feeling well? The conscious mind that's illuminating the body that is healthy. The conscious being that illumines the mind that has shanti. Conscious being that illumines the mind that is upset. The conscious being that illumines the mind that has meditated and meditated and meditated and meditated and enjoys, you know, an exalted enjoys on a frequent basis, on a daily basis, exalted states of experience. What about a mind and a person who's practiced all different types of tapas and austerities and learns how to astral travel and go to different dimensions and have experiences in different dimensions, which we, in the Hindu understanding, all of those different dimensions are there. And you can learn to do all of these things and do a little astral traveling.
You buy a ticket.
But the question is, okay, so now I'm saying to you, I am a great astral traveler who has very blissful meditative experiences throughout the day on a daily basis every day, you know, and I have all other sorts of things going for me also. I can become big and I can become small and I can become light and I can be heavy. I have all of these siddhis. I have all of these different siddhis. And I can also, you know, make things happen by the focus of my will. I can do all of these things, you know. And so now I have become an enlightened being. This is what, I mean, we really have to figure all this stuff out. Because is this what it means to be an enlightened being? Does the accumulation, you know, of powers, we're going to talk in the next verse on this, but does the accumulation of powers or qualities or mental states, is that what it means to be an enlightened being? Or to have spiritual experiences, or even to have experiences of nirvikalpa samadhi, where your mind is totally resolved in something that you don't know? I'm serious. What does it mean? Would you say that when you've collected all of these different types of experiences, all of which, by the way, do come and go, there's no such thing as having an experience in the body, a bodily experience, or a mental or emotional experience that doesn't come and go. Mm-hmm. It's because it's the nature of the creation, it's the nature of the body, it's the nature of the mind. You can have the most profound experiences, the most blissful experiences, the most profound meditative experiences, the most spiritual experience in the healthiest body. As long as you maintain it, you try to maintain it, you try to maintain it, but it comes and goes. That's the nature of things. And so is the collection of these changing experiences, or even having a predominance of certain types of experience, I would say, is that self-knowledge? Is that liberation? And if it is, what is liberating about it? What is liberating about it? What if you say, you know, when they have they use the example of the drowning man? The drowning man is the example, goes like this. I'm just going to use it to the extreme now. A guy's out in the ocean, swimming out in the ocean, has gone out too far, and gets caught by an undertow. The undertow pulls him down under the water, and then keeps him down there, and then pushes him up as the undertow releases him, pushes him up out of the water, then pulls him down, then pushes him up, and pulls him down, and pushes him up. Now, let's say that the pushing up, when he's up, he is having the most wonderful spiritual experience that you can possibly imagine. Okay. And everything is beautiful and blissful and wonderful, only to be pulled down again, to have that wonderful, beautiful experience disappear. To be pushed up again. Oh, thank goodness, it's back. To be pulled down again, oh my gosh, it's gone again. Am I ever going to be good enough to have this experience stay? Will I ever be one of the enlightened enlightens? Will I ever be one of those who has an experience that will stay? And that's what some people work for. They have these sublime experiences, wonderful experiences, but they keep coming down from them, and so they judge their ascent into spiritual maturity by how long the experience lasts. And so I actually call this, not just me, but others too, I call this spiritual samsara. Spiritual samsara. You know? Because I'm just stuck in samsara on a different level. I'm stuck in samsara on a different level because I am still totally bound by the nature of the universe. I'm still totally identified with the universe, you know, which on every level is bound by change, bound by birth and death. And so if for me to be free requires the universe to stop its motion, you know, so that I can be free, you know, or for me to gain any type of a mental state as opposed to another state so that I can be whole and complete, that isn't going to work. And there will never be a time that other people, somebody else, isn't maintaining that mental state longer than I am. And so somehow, you know, we have to get beyond these mental states, whether they be depressed ones or spiritual ones, if you want to be free. If you're attached to any kind of state, there's only dukkha, there's only suffering. To the degree that you're attached to any state at all, there's suffering, because all states come to an end. And so what you want, if there's such a thing as moksha or liberation, is to be attached to that which doesn't come and go, cannot come and go. Even if you wanted it to come and go, it can't come and go. If you wanted to make it better, you can't make it better. And if you want to make it worse, you can't make it worse. If you want to get rid of it, you can't get rid of it. There's nothing you can do. And not only that, nobody else can do it either. Nobody else can get rid of it for you or do anything to you to harm it or touch it, just like nobody can do anything to space. You know, you can't do anything to space and nobody can do anything to space. Your being is something which is also, nobody can touch it, nobody can, including you, make it better or make it worse, nor do they need to. Or do you want them to? Or do you want to? You can't and you don't want to. And that's freedom. And that freedom is yourself already. If it wasn't yourself, it wouldn't... If it wasn't yourself, it's a hopeless situation. Let me put it in a different way. If the self that you want to be, you aren't already that. Right? If you aren't already the self that you want to be, it's a sorry situation. It's a sorry situation because that means that that self that you want to be, you have to become.
You have to get there.
You have to become it. You have to get there. You have to attain it. If you have to become it, get there, or attain it, it's existing within samsara. It's existing within duality. It's existing with change. And so you may attain it, but what you're attaining is a mental state that's subject to change. And if it's subject to change, the loss of the attainment is disappointing. Just as the loss of your new car, the loss of your new partner, or the loss of your new job, or the loss of whatever it is that you want, you know? The loss of your wonderful physical vitality because you've stopped doing your yoga, or you've, you know, given up being a vegan and are now, you know... eating hamburgers, whatever it is, you know, you've lost that, you've lost it, you know. So you need something. If there's such a thing as moksha, you know, it's the recognition of something that is and cannot be lost, something that has not come into being, is not going out of being, something that simply is, and that's exactly what your nature is. Now, what's the relationship? And of course, what is the relationship of me, if such a thing is, to all of this? Well, that's what we have to keep teaching, and we have to keep recognizing. One way of recognizing it is that really the most obvious. Here you are. There is only one thing about you that doesn't change. Everything else changes. Everything. Everything that you can perceive, everything that you can objectify, that changes. The whole creation, anything that can exist within the dream, anything that can exist within manifest creation, it's objectifiable and it changes. But that is not the only thing that is there. You are also there. You are not objectified as an object. You are the conscious being, the me, that is present to every experience that you have. You can change the experiences and the experiences change. Both are true. You can change the experiences change. It means your mind can, you can work with your mind to impact itself, to change itself. You can work with the body to change the body. You can clean your house. You can buy a new house. You can get a new job. You can, you know, associate with different people. You can practice different mental disciplines. All of these things you have some control over changing. And so these states, all states, come into being and go, and you can affect that also. But there's one thing that you cannot affect and do nothing about, and that is you, the one who is present to all of those changing conditions. You are there. You'll never say, you know, the world is taking place and I'm here, but I'm totally unaware of it. It's not true. You're sitting here, you have sense organs, you have a mind, you have thoughts, you're aware of the whole thing. Right? All perceptions are taking place in you. There's no one behind you, the awareful being, that lights up all of this activity. There's no awareness behind awareness. That would be kind of a you're really getting into a non-dual type of infinite regress. I'm aware of awareness because of awareness. Awareness is aware of awareness is aware of awareness of aware of it. You know, it's an infinite regress. Awareness doesn't need an awareness to light awareness up. Awareness is awareness. The sun doesn't need another sun to come in and make it shine. You don't need any other awareness to come in and make you awareness. You are the awareness. You are the awareful being. Right? So try to do something about that. Just think about it. When you meditate, even you have a meditative practice, you're continually withdrawing, you know, your sense organs. You relax your body. Why do you relax your body? So it's not bothering you. You relax the body so the body can just be there, you know, relaxed, not drawing away your attention. You try to be in a quiet space so it doesn't really draw out your sense organs. You relax your sense organs, simply let them be. You relax your mind, you can simply let it be, so that you can recognize the one who is present to all of that. That's the way at least we like to guide meditation. So you relax all of these things. So you're not messing with them, not giving them unnecessary focus. You're just letting them be so that you can become more aware of just your own presence that's lighting up all of this phenomena. And then let your mind try to change that presence. The mind can change itself. It can change its thoughts. It can quieten its thoughts. But now let's say you can say to your mind, all right, you can do all of these things. You can change the way you are. You can make yourself more quiet, you know. Let's see, what can we do something to the awareness that's illumining me? Can I do something to it? Can I make it any different than what it is? You can try. And you'll find, like space, your being is something that you can't touch. You are. You just simply are. You can't touch it. When your mind becomes quiet, you know, your mind is not competing with your own presence. That's even why we bother to meditate, to slow down the competition, right? So that just gives you a time to just recognize your own silent, abiding presence. And then you ask, you have to let your mind ask, what is the nature of this, of me? What is this me like? Is it full or is it depressed? Is the consciousness depressed? No. Is it agitated? No. Is it sad? No. Is it happy? Is it blissful? No. In fact, it's not any of those things. What are the words that you would use? The mystics use the word the beloved. Why would this presence be called the beloved? You know? Why would it be called Ananda? Why are the Murtis in India all had this eyes closed, sitting in with a totally relaxed body with this really gentle smile? They're not doing anything. They're not participating in the world. They're just simply with the presence of your being. What is that? Can you change it? Is it ever not there? This is a great walking meditation. In fact, if you're irritated or agitated, you can just say to yourself, am I still there? It's a good meditation. Am I still there? You know? Just check it out and see if you're still there. You're still there. You're the only thing that is still there. Once you start to notice yourself, you realize that you become, you know, in the gestalt, you become more in the forefront. Because you realize, in fact, your presence is the center of every experience that's there. It's the changeless center. Your being is the changeless center of all experience. And it never varies in any way at all. And that self is free. It is that self that is liberated. So, in fact, moksha is the recognition of the self that is liberated. There's nothing else here that's liberated. In a sense, everything is bound by death. Everything is bound by change. Everything comes and goes. It all's born, decays, dies, goes. Except for you. Right? And so now, the self that is liberated is that self, but the mind also, we say in a secondary way, is liberated. Now the mind is liberated. Why? Not because it doesn't go on changing, but because it has recognized that itself is liberated. So the self, which is the self of the mind, is a free self. And so then the mind is never away from the free self. Right? There's no distance between the mind and the self. The mind enjoys your conscious being completely. Now, it's not that there's a part of your mind that's away from conscious being. Not at all. But what we don't realize is that the conscious being that you are, which your mind totally enjoys, is changeless, is non-objectifiable. It's not subject to duality. It doesn't come and go. Once you realize that, the mind always has there's no distance between it and a changeless self any more than there is of a pot and its clay, a clay pot. Now, there's no distance. There's no separation. The pot is clay. Your being, the mind is yourself, but yourself is totally free of the mind. It's not changing at all. So now you think, if I look at this room, here's this room that I'm perceiving right now through my sense organs, right? And this, because of my sense organs, because of my eyes, my mind is forming a thought modification, right, of the room through my eyes. That's why I see you. If my mind was daydreaming, I'd have my eyes open, but I wouldn't be seeing you. So my mind is forming a thought modification now of this room. If I'm looking like this, now it's a thought modification of the book, right? Whatever's going on, there's a thought modification. That thought modification is the form of the pot, right? The self of the pot is the clay. So the form, every thought modification gives as though a shape or a form, as though. But it's not like the clay pot, because the clay is taking the form of the pot, you know. It stays as clay, but it takes the form of the pot. Your consciousness doesn't ever have a form to take. It's formless. But this Maya creation is not away from it in any way. I had to move a little away from the clay pot because I don't want... Clay pot, this clay pot example is a wonderful example, but it's circumscribed. It's a wonderful example because I can so sit here for an hour and talk about it. How there's really only clay here, but there's a pot, but in fact, there's only clay. There's no pot away from the clay. The only thing really here is clay. I can talk about the mind like that. The mind, there is nothing... There's nothing. The mind is nothing but an awareful being. The awareness, the you that you are, is not away. It's not separate from the mind. But the difference is, and this is where you have to understand the difference between the clay pot and you, is that in the creation we can use this satya mitya example, where the truth of the clay, of the pot, is the clay. That's what's really there. And the pot depends on it for its being. That's how we use it, right? But the pot enjoys the same order of reality. I mean, as the clay itself is an object in the creation. It's material in the creation. And so all you can use this clay pot for is the relationship between the form and the substance. That the form has no being apart from the substance. So now here, and the substance is not dependent upon the form. That's what you have to see here. But here, inside of you, in your own experience, you are a conscious being that illumines a vritti, a thought, which comes in the whole vritti, okay, comes and goes in consciousness without consciousness changing in any way. Consciousness doesn't change to become the vritti, to take on the shape of the vritti. Like clay doesn't change in its essence, but it takes on the shape of the pot. See what I mean? The clay is in a lump, so now it's the shape of a lump. And then you change it, and the same clay, without losing its nature, becomes the shape of a pot. Awareness doesn't become the shape of the thought. It doesn't become the shape of the earth or of the universe. Awareness is not objectifiable to become any shape. Awareness is pure being. It doesn't have the shape of anything within Maya. And yet Maya, the whole creation, doesn't have any being apart from it. And so that's what we have to recognize here, that in your internal landscape, you don't take on the shape of anything. You're the being that everything enjoys. Everything shines because of you, but you don't take on the shape of anything. That's the Satyam Mitya. So I see we're going to have to do this verse more next week.
Oh, good.
Yeah, we'll do it more next week.
Yeah. A double dose.
A double dose. Purnamadah Purnamidam Purnat Purnamadachate Purnasya Purnamadaya Purnameva Vasishyate Om Shanti 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 Harihi Om Shri Gurubhyo Namaha Harihi Om.
You said
that
I lost my concentration. You said
the
consciousness doesn't change.
Mm-hmm.
The heat.
Oh, okay.
Everything is you.
See, the clay pot, I just felt I had to kind of bring this point up. The problem with the clay pot, or even the wave ocean, is that because these are material, the clay is a material that exists within duality. Clay isn't everything. It's not non-dual, right? And so even though in that example, clay doesn't lose its nature, it does mold itself to become, take the form of the pot, and then mold itself, or something molds it to take the form of the plate. Similarly with the water in the ocean. The water stays water, but it changes shape. It is changing shape, right? Even though its essence isn't changing. Here, there's no shape shifting for awareness. Awareness doesn't have a shape to change a shape. It's not objectifiable to be something that changes in its form or changes to become anything. Like, you can think of, like, you can have a vision of, say, for instance, there is nothing but awareness. But awareness is somehow modifying itself to change into the creation. That's impossible. Once you say non-dual, there's nothing but awareness, because there's no place. If there's nothing but awareness and it's non-dual, there is no second thing to be changing, mm-hmm. like a clay pot. Right?
So in relation to the thought?
So now in relationship to the thought, some people think that you're awareness, but you know, you're taking on these forms. And I'm saying, no, you're never taking on any form at all. You're always exactly the same, right? And Maya, which is responsible for this whole thing, including the mind, is something which is manifesting, changing, this, you know, modifying, but it's modifying in the stillness of yourself. That's why, for instance, when you're meditating and we were focusing on the sounds of the children. All of that activity is taking place in the being of yourself. The activity comes when the activity is there, when the sound is there, when the perception is there. That perception enjoys the being of yourself. And it enjoys and it shines because of the consciousness of yourself. But it itself, but the being of yourself, the consciousness, is not going through any modification whatsoever as that Maya goes on modifying. Maya, whether it be the thoughts in the mind or the aging of the physical body or the perceptions of the world or the nature. Nothing at all is happening. It's not like it's going through any transformative process. Staying as awareness, but moving somehow, as though it has some relationship with movement or duality. The only relationship it has with Maya is that it is the Satchit of Maya. It is the conscious being which the Maya enjoys. But the Maya doesn't have any capacity to touch it or change it or modify it in any way. And yet, without the Satchit, the Maya would have no being, and that would be like taking, you know, the pot out of the clay or taking the rope out of the snake. You know, you take what is actually there away from it, and that thing is not there.
You make it sound like awareness, conscious being that is already accomplished, I am already free, and it's just a question of having to notice that or give it a little bit of focus. Is that?
That's right. It's removing the ignorance. That's why. Hi, Tibby.
Hi, Tibbs.
It's removing the ignorance. If it weren't that, then there's something for you that you have to accomplish. Then you're within duality. Everything within duality is subject to change, to birth and death.
Well,
and so then your moksha also, what you would call moksha, doesn't exist, really.
What would you say if you always, you have the urge of being better, you know? That better, where should that land? Not, it can't land on myself.
Yeah. Yeah, that lands on, like, for instance, if the, and it's natural to, say if the body, for instance, you know, is not well, has any type of illness or something, then it's natural to want to fix that. Even though the body will eventually die, you still want to keep it as healthy as possible while you're living. You know, we do our best, even with our little addictions and all the different big problems that get in the way, you know. We do our best to keep it healthy. The mind, too, the mind is capable of creating a lot of pain, and depending upon your childhood, can be lots of, you know, insecurities or feeling and judgments toward yourself, and this person's better than me, and this person's worse than, somebody's better than you, and somebody's worse than you too. You know, all of these different judgments that cause emotional pain.
Yeah.
We want to fix those things. That's natural. You know, if there's something that's causing a disturbance, then you want to fix it, but you're dealing with in duality. But there's someone there that needs no fixing. And that, it's a tremendous relief to recognize the one that is whole and complete, and there's no way to make it better or worse, nor do you want to. That one needs no fixing. And that one blesses the mind that's trying to fix all of these other things. And there's nothing wrong with fixing things if something's disturbing, you know. But it's not you that needs to be fixed. You know, it's the mind or the habit or the illness in the body, or, you know, the house needs to be cleaned. I mean, it's all kinds of things, you know, need to be maintained and fixed, and with all different ways we can make things better. We can also work on our mind to make it more alert, or, you know, to make it more, give it more shanti, to be more careful in our behavior and all these things. The psychology work to take care of inner child work and all of that. That's all fine. You know, but that's all Maya. That's not you.
Mm-hmm.
So self-knowledge is really the recognizing the one who blesses all of that, who is you, and who is there changelessly whole and complete, and is the very self of this whole creation.
Mm-hmm.
Doesn't even just stop with recognizing, you know, your being. It's recognizing who you are in reference to this whole. And what is the relationship of all of these things that you're fixing, you know, to you? You know, what is the relationship? And that's where the Ishwara comes in, and the Satyam Mitya, and all of these things that are so important.
Well, what is the relationship?
The relationship, well, there's different relationships, all of which are important. One is recognize, once you recognize your freedom, the nature of yourself, as being not in any way encumbered by duality, by Maya, right? Because that's all objectifiable. Then the self I am is the self that you are, is the self that Ishwara is, because it's only room for one self. If it can't be objectified within duality, then there's nothing to make it two, because space itself is part of the creation. So there's only one self. So that means that this creation has one self. So now we have Ishwara. The creation itself has only one self, the self, which is the self that you are. And so now the creation is not inert. It's not like an inert Mother Nature, like a machine of some sort. It's a conscious being, and the conscious being has for its consciousness yourself. So the self, this innermost self that you are, is the self that the whole creation enjoys. Okay? And so now you are a conscious being as a jiva, body, mind, sense organs. Now from the standpoint of the jiva, this body, mind, sense organs, which enjoys me, the conscious being, is in this creation, which is a conscious being. Right? And so now, and the creation that is a conscious being is the conscious being which illumines all jivas, so which is me. So I illumine the entire creation and everything in it, right, from the standpoint of consciousness. So now if I realize that, now this conscious being here, which is me, has a relationship with a much bigger me, right, with Ishwara.
But there's no bigger.
Let me start again.
Okay.
Because it seems like you're saying two different. You're saying conscious being.
Yeah, I'm talking from Ishwara. Let me do it again.
Okay.
This jiva is part of Ishwara. Is that right?
Yeah.
The jiva, the body, mind, sense organ, is a part to the whole. Your body is a part of Ishwara, of the Lord. Ishwara is Ishwara, because Lord has all other kinds of meanings. So your body is part of Ishwara. Because even when we do the drik drisha, the seer seeing differentiation, what are you doing? You're giving this body, mind, sense organs, even the eye notion, to the creation. It's now an object within the creation. And the consciousness which you are now is not limited to this body. It's illumining the entire creation. And the one, and this entire creation is illumined by the consciousness which I am. Because once I differentiate the body and the mind and the sense organs and see that they're objectified, then the consciousness, I'm left, right? The consciousness doesn't become the one that I'm looking at or objectifying. I remain as the conscious being. So what that means then is that I am the self of Ishwara, and I am the self of everything in Ishwara. Like when I do the meadow, I am the self of the meadow that I imagine, and I am the self of everything in the meadow. I am the sat-chit of the sat-chit of the entire meadow. Now, because there's ignorance, the creatures in the meadow are all going to say, "I am the conscious being. I am the conscious being." If the tree could talk, it'd say, "I am the conscious being." You know. But in fact, there's only one conscious being, which is the truth of the whole meadow. And that conscious being is me, the one from whom the meadow has come. So now I can say, I am the conscious being of the whole universe. But the one who's speaking is the jiva. So if I, the individual, say, I am the conscious being of the whole universe, I am Ishwara, I cannot be stuck talking from the standpoint of the jiva. I have to be talking from the standpoint of myself, consciousness, from whom this whole universe has come, but I am embodied within that universe, and it's because I've gained self-knowledge that I can say that. I can't say that I, this jiva, am Ishwara. right? I can't say this body, mind, sense organs is Ishvara. That's like the wave saying, I'm the ocean. The wave has to first recognize I'm the water and that the water is the truth of the ocean. So I have to recognize I'm the conscious being, you know, from whom the whole creation has come. Like you can recognize that on a meadow.
Excuse me. When you say conscious being, do you mean like
Sat Chit?
Okay, thank you.
Conscious being.
Okay.
Being is Sat and okay. Conscious is Chit.
Okay.
I'm the Sat Chit from which the whole creation has come. But from the standpoint of this body, mind, sense organs, I'm a part of this whole creation. And so then, but say I understand that this whole creation is a manifestation, you know, of knowledge, of Maya, that has for its being consciousness. Then I can have a different relationship now between myself as a jiva, this body, mind, sense organs, and Ishvara. Because Ishvara is the whole me. This body, mind, sense organs is just a part of that. Now, the whole infinite expression of knowledge is Ishvara. This body, mind, sense organs is a very limited part of that infinite expression. And so that's why I can always look to see how Ishvara is handling the situation. Because I can't have that infinite knowledge as a jiva. But I can rely on that infinite knowledge, you know, in terms of how Ishvara is unfolding and what my place is in it.
And how much do you give over to that? I mean,
for me, I mean, how much do I give over for it? It's the constancy of my vision. Now you could say, let me put it like this. If you have to think like that, how much do I give over it? Where it's, you know, who knows better, me or Ishvara? You know? Then, if you're... I guess the golden rule is you don't worry about it and you always follow Dharma. Whatever you do, don't let it go against you.
I don't think I was trying to say that. I was... It's a little shocking to the system to think that this is all really being taken care of and he will see it, that Ishvara will see it all the way through and not to worry.
Well, it depends. The reason that people worry, this is the reason that people worry. For one, well, let's not talk about the realities of you're all going to die and get a disease.
That's a big reality.
You know, like in Panchadashi, Vidyaranya says to the student who's kind of realizing the realities of having a human birth, he just says, I'm sorry, you've already taken this birth, what can I do? You know,
you're going to die.
That birth and death and kind of the vagaries of the creation, we will all have to deal with that. That's part of having a human life. But there's a relationship with Ishvara and kind of an understanding the prarabdha karma. In other words, your life is part of a bigger story that takes you from your birth to your death and your next birth to your death. You're always part of Ishvara's story,
mm-hmm.
You know. And so if you're not asking the world to make you happy, like for instance, this is the samsara. You come into this birth and you always have what you have, always, moment to moment to moment. You have what you have, it's already here. But that's a problem because I'm not happy. So you don't realize that you're already completely situated in this creation. You couldn't be more situated than you are. And where you are situated right now is yours. There's nothing anybody can do about it. But say you're looking over at Mary Sue over here, or Johnny over here, you know, or the Smiths over here. And they have this and that and the other thing, and they seem to be happier than me. they have more things than me, or I want that, and, you know, there's all kinds of imaginations that go on. I need this in order to be happy. I need to look like this in order to be happy. I need to have this type of a mind in order to be happy. All of these are all these projections. And then you just get angry at Ishwar. Why didn't you make me like this so that I could be happy like they're happy? And it just gets on and on and on, very complicated. But what if you have discovered that the source of the ananda you're seeking in all of these objects and all of these accomplishments is your own being, and your mind is not away from that being at all. All it needs to do is relax. Mm. You know, if it gains knowledge and it can relax, then the wholeness that it's trying to attain from the world, it already has. Mm. It recognizes that. And so then when that's the case, then you can be with your life, the life that you have, which is this one right here, you know. And then you live this life, and it gives you plenty to do. You never have to worry about it. There's always something for you to do. There's always something for you to handle, something to take care of, something to be part of. There's never going to be a time from birth to death that this life, that your life, isn't unfolding. And if you look backwards, you can always appreciate kind of the storyline of your life. And then you can realize that, gee, 5 years ago, did I know I would be here today? Probably not. You know, all kinds of your life has all kinds of twists and turns, you know. And so you can take a position where I kind of enjoy my life because I feel held by Ishwara. I feel held by Ishwara, and I'm excited to see what comes next.
I see.
Like Swamiji says, you know, I do just what's in front of me every day to the best of my ability. I do my best with what's in front of me, all of the things that, you know, are coming my way, I do those. And that's what it is. Recently he said, you know, a Vedantin has to be somebody who can live day by day. And that doesn't mean, you know, every day is a new day. And that day comes and you do what needs to be done in that day. He's not at all talking about being flippant or irresponsible, but it's that your duties and that your responsibilities and your planning for the future, all of these things, they all come at the proper time, and you take care of them as they come. So if that's living your life, but really it's responding to your life or responding to Ishwara, that's why sometimes the whole life is looked as a puja, as a prayer. Prayer in the sense that it's a constant relationship with Bhagavan, because your life is continually being given to you and you're participating in it. And if you look at that as a dialogue with Ishwara, then that's much more gratifying and it works better. It works better than when you look at this world as kind of a concrete creation, inert creation, and you're this little pocket of consciousness that has to figure the whole thing out, and it's very, very burdensome.
Yeah.
And it's also not true. And half of the things you try to figure out, you don't figure out. Half of the things you want to do have nothing to do with what you're supposed to do. It's just banging your head against the wall. If you just stop and relax and do what's there, the opportunities that are being given, then you'll feel much more in tune with your life and with the universe and with Ishwara. It works better.
Yeah. Oh, that was helpful.
Radha, when you say the prarabdha is there, you know, it's already set for each of our lives. Mm-hmm. Does that mean it's set for the jiva that you take yourself to be?
Yeah, not for the self, for the atma, there's no prarabdha or anything like that. Uh-huh. So the jiva that's taken this particular body is because of certain karmas, past karmas, are manifesting now at an appropriate time based upon your last life. There's an infinite number of karmas. This, you have to have Shraddha and what the Vedas have to say around this, but I'm just telling you what they say.
Okay.
There's like an infinite, beginningless number of karmas that are there in your account that based upon the trajectory of your last life, that really the dharmic trajectory, a trajectory of your last life and your interests and all, that will determine what karmas are going to manifest for this life. And then, of course, within the life, the karmas that take you from birth to death, you have free will within that. But the free will is within that trajectory, you know. So, like, you weren't born in India, or you weren't born, you know, a century ago, perhaps, or whatever. You were born into this particular situation that has a limited scope in terms of what types of things you're going to be experiencing from birth to death. And so there's just a series of major, the major drift of your life from birth to death, it unfolds as part of the Ishwar story. And within that you have some limited movement. Not a lot, actually. It's not a lot. Just look at your own life, like you can think even when you're in a relationship. You could think, you know, you can think, I want to be in a relationship. It never comes until it finally comes. In a relationship, you want to get out of that relationship. You never get out of it until you finally get out of it. You want to move to another place that you imagine would be better for you. But you never move until you move. It's all just imagination, you know, and then tremendous worry.
Yeah.
Worry and angst about it all.
And how am I going to develop that plan?
Mm-hmm. There's also all kinds of interesting things that go on in a person's mind. Like, you can have all kinds of imaginations, even recurring imaginations about what you would like to do or what you may be doing. But you can tell that they're only an imagination because there's no one inside that's going to do that right now. Maybe later. But you still, you know, tend the imagination. But then you should just stop and ask yourself, are you ready to do that now? Is this something that you want to do now? And often the answer will be, no, not really, not now. If you're ready to do it now, it's not an imagination. It's already in motion. It's already happening. Yeah. But a lot of our mind can be lost in kind of this imaginal world of imagination. It's just an imaginal world where there's nobody inside that's going to act on it. And I think it's very helpful if you find yourself lost in that one, to just say, are you ready to do something like that right now?
And the urge all the time is to make it better.
Yeah, you think it would be better.
Things will be better.
You think that, but then you, when you ask yourself, is this what I want to do now? The answer is probably no, because otherwise it would already be in motion. You know.
But that's an illusion of trying to make things better. If you look at your own being, it's already better.
Yeah. That's right. And sometimes when you're trying to make things better by changing everything, it's good to just stop and ask yourself, you know, what really would make this better? Like, you just slow down and you ask yourself, what is it that's really bothering me right now?
I don't know if you answered the question, but at one point you said the reason why people worry is, and then I can put it together, but yeah. I wonder if you can answer that question directly.
They worry because they're worried about not getting what they need to get to be happy, mm-hmm. or losing what they have. That they need what they have to be happy and then they lose it, or they need to get something in order to be happy, mm-hmm. and they may not get it. That's what it amounts to.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. We done.